This is WJBC This Week.
The conversation begins when we upset people enough to where they want to stand up against us so that we can tell them what we're not standing up for.
It's really important that we respect and show a lot of respect for the guys that have fought for the country and died for our country.
We're thinking about going to the governor now and saying, is this not executive order time? And utilizing police, utilizing firemen, even utilizing our reserves, our National Guard.
Is that really the best use of taxpayer dollars to be resurfacing, widening roads that are not needed?
We might never build an east side highway.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Starr. On this week's program, two Illinois Wesleyan football players discuss their kneeling protest during the national anthem. Senator Dick Durbin reacts to the skyrocketing price of the EpiPen and the congressional grilling of the company's CEO. A report warns of an impending teacher shortage crisis. Actress and songwriter Linda Thompson shares details of her marriage to Bruce Jenner, her romance with Elvis Presley, and life in and out of the public eye. And a Lincoln historian compares Clinton Trump with Lincoln Douglas. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The conversation that began when NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick kneeled during the playing of the national anthem before a game last month was brought close to home this week as two Illinois Wesleyan football players, Quincy Butler and Jamal Jackson, two seniors from the Chicago suburbs, took the same stance during the Titans football game against North Central. The two business marketing majors say they plan to continue the protest throughout the season. Butler and Jackson talked to WJBC This Week.
I guess I'll start with you, Jamal. What first motivated you guys to sort of follow suit, if you will?
What really motivated us was the guys on the team were talking, and there's issues that we faced pretty much our whole life, our whole time in college, issues that are constantly in the news with injustices in society. And we're usually, there's not really many things we can do to support our cause. We don't have a lot of money, so we can't, there's nothing to donate to. Being involved in sports and in school, we don't have a bunch of free time, so we noticed what Colin Kaepernick did was something that we were easily able to replicate and do ourselves to basically put a little bit of action behind what we believe in.
Quincy, what did you first think when you saw Colin do what he did?
Well, initially I just wanted to make sure I understood, you know, the things that, you know, he was, you know, taking that knee for. And, you know, when he kind of laid out the things as far as, you know, the social injustices people of color deal with, the issue with police brutality and racial profiling, those are all things that I've been, you know, looking at more and more, you know, as I've been in college, and it really affects me. And so, I mean, I couldn't do more than, you know, support him and what he was doing. And the fact that he went and said that he stressed the fact that he wasn't meaning any type of disrespect to the military or anybody like that made me, you know, feel more assured that that's something that, you know, I support and could see myself doing. So,
Jamal, you talked about injustices, and Quincy, you would allude to that too. If you're comfortable sharing what kind of injustices, not only that you see perhaps in society, but what you feel you've personally been a subject to.
Well, there's a bunch of small things that I could probably touch on, whether it be being pulled over for no reason and given a ticket. I've actually been given maybe 7 tickets while driving, like pulled over and given tickets, and all of them dropped once I get to court because they're not really meaningful tickets, such as being pulled over because I'm listening to loud music in a quiet neighborhood or whatever. And then when I get pulled over, I ask the officer, oh, so was I doing anything wrong? Just wait here a second. Okay, they run my information, come back to the car with tickets for one headlight being out. Well, no, one headlight being dimmer than the other. That's what the ticket was for, so improper use of headlights. I had my license, and my wallet was in my backpack, and I say, oh, can I grab my wallet out of my backpack? No, that's fine. And then I come back. He comes back and gives me a ticket for driving without a license. And then once I get to court, they're like, oh, well, we'll drop this. And that was just one small example. Like,
and I guess what the connection that you're making is if you were white, that would not have happened.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I was driving through a predominantly white neighborhood on a Sunday night around 11 o'clock at night, driving this tiny little red sports car. So it looks a little souped up, and that's a reason to be profiled. That's one example I can give. I don't know.
Quincy, any stories like that for you to share?
Well, yeah, I have a similar story when I was pulled over before, and I guess my biggest issue, I didn't get a ticket or anything, which is me asking the officer, you know, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And I think his reasoning was you weren't staying straight in your lane. I found out to be, you know, maybe a little bit of a cop-out. I thought maybe he could have been looking for something else. But honestly, besides, you know, instances of getting pulled over, something that I've been kind of looking into and thinking about is the lack of business ownership when it comes to people of color. And, you know, something growing up, I had a lot of friends that dads own businesses and restaurants and things like that. I never really, you know, thought about it in the way that, you know, those are usually my white friends that have parents and grandparents own businesses. Why isn't it my, you know, my cousins or my uncles, or my dad or my grandfather who owns businesses? And, you know, when I think more and more on it and I think about, you know, usually my friends with parents and whatnot that, you know, have family members that own businesses, they're usually doing great financially, and they really don't have much issues to worry about. And so I like to tie this back into, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, people of color really struggled to be able to you know, own their own businesses for just because that's how the culture was. And, you know, they wouldn't grant, you know, proper business loans and things like that to people of color. And so, you know, when I look at, you know, the African-American race and people of color today, and I try to, you know, understand, you know, why what's the struggle coming from? Why, you know, why aren't we in the financial situations that we can be comfortable and live without worry? That's something I look to, and you know, and even though I never really looked at it growing up as something that, you know, directly hurt me, when I open my eyes and see, you know, who benefits off of it and who doesn't, you know, it bothers me a little bit. And, you know, not to be bitter or to look at, you know, my white friends and stuff like that, and I don't think they should, you know, feel sorry for themselves or anything like that, but you know, it's just stuff that comes up and I think about, and, you know, I hope to make a change, you know, for stuff like that. So, yeah.
So I guess that would be the next step, and Colin Kaepernick has been asked of this, and fair to ask each of you. It's one thing, of course, to bring to light issues that you feel need addressed, but then how do you go about making change, and how do you help in that cause?
Yeah, so like Jamal kind of pointed to it earlier, we don't have that $1 million to donate to, you know, some of these, you know, charities and whatnot that organizations that help out some of these issues. But, you know, something that I think has a lot of value, especially when you talk about, you know, our generation being the next generation to take over and really, you know, lead change in this world, in our country, is just me having a conversation with my teammates and my friends and making sure that they understand, you know, what's going on, you know, in our society, and making sure that their minds aren't in places where that when they have kids, they're telling them the wrong thing, so that, you know, besides moving to a more progressive and equal, you know, country, we're still kind of stagnating or not really getting what we need. So I think just for me, having a conversation with teammates and friends and kind of educating them on, you know, what the things are is enough for me, honestly.
I'm sure you both have heard and have considered some of the backlash that Colin Kaepernick, for one, faced. Some saying that it was disrespectful, that he was being ungrateful, and at best they would support his effort, but maybe not the time and place for it because it's now wrapped into the sense of patriotism. Do you have concerns about that, and have you heard about backlash directly from what you guys have done?
Well, no one has directly said anything to me. I'm not sure about Quincy, but I know overall, the my main idea, I'm not trying to disrespect any of the military. Every male on my father's side of the family and even on my mother's side of the family has served in the military. And I don't think that me exercising my First Amendment right is disrespectful. There's actually interestingly enough, you know, the standing during the national anthem for football games, I don't know if I'm wrong in this, but from what I've read, it wasn't always a thing. The Defense Department, the U.S. Department of Defense, actually paid money to the NFL to have them stand for the national anthem because it was a way to make athletes look more patriotic. So before they even decided, oh, we're going to spend a couple million dollars here to get them to stand up and look more patriotic, this wouldn't have been an issue. And then the idea of, you know, maybe this isn't the time or the place. Well, my response to that is, when is the time or the place to talk about issues? There's, if you look at it, pretty much every other time someone tries to find a way to protest, whether it be a march, a peaceful march, or, you know, sometimes it escalates and turns to a riot, which I'm not necessarily condoning, but, you know, or, I don't know, town hall meetings. There's always somebody that's going to object to it and say, well, maybe not this way, maybe not that way. Well, the way I see it, this is a way, and it's better than no way at all.
That was our chat with the Illinois Wesleyan football players Quincy Butler and Jamal Jackson. The entire interview is available at WJBC.com. University President Eric Jensen and football coach Norm Esch have both said they support their players' right to peacefully protest. Outraged Republican and Democratic lawmakers grilled Mylan CEO Heather Bresch this week about the steep cost increases of her company's life-saving EpiPens and the profits for a company with sales in excess of $11 billion. The list price of EpiPens has grown to $608 for a two-pack, an increase of more than 500% since 2007. Senator Dick Durbin talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
Is there anything the federal government can do about this other than scold her publicly?
Well, first, I don't believe she's doing anything illegal, and that is a shame. It's a disgrace that Congress has not enacted laws, and the president hasn't signed them, to give us some say, some voice when it comes to overcharging for pharmaceuticals. I mean, they can just charge whatever they want. And if it's a life-or-death drug, people are going to be forced to buy it or face the consequences. That is awful. And, yes, we should be doing something about giving the government the authority. Let me say a word about EpiPens. I introduced a bill giving incentives for schools to put in this kind of EpiPen because kids have reactions. Somebody, a classmate, brings a peanut butter sandwich, puts it on the table next to a child with a terrible reaction. The child could die if they don't have immediate response from EpiPens. But when I did it, those EpiPens were a fraction of what they're charging today. And there isn't the kind of competition we anticipated here. So, yes, Mylan Pharmaceuticals has abused its right to make and sell this drug, this life-and-death drug for kids primarily, and we need to have more congressional authority. Why do drugs cost a fraction in the Canada as they do in the United States? Because the Canadian government stands up for its citizens and says we're not going to let these pharmaceutical companies run away with their pricing. Exactly the same drugs. We need to do the same thing.
You know, I understand why the Senate went and grilled the CEO of Wells Fargo, because there was illegal activity there. But when you put the CEO of this pharmaceutical company in front of the legislators, I guess I want to know what's the purpose behind it, because there really is nothing they can do.
It builds up momentum for Congress to take action. It's curious. This is the second time that this committee over in the House, that is, of course, under the control of the Republicans, have called in pharmaceutical companies. It kind of puts them on the spot. If you don't like what they're doing, what do you want to do about it? Now, yeah. Many of them have said, you know, it's a free market. Let's keep the government out of it. Well, we have a free market. The government is out of it, and look what we have. There are moments in time where we need to have the government step in on behalf of citizens. And in this situation, what choice do you have? A life-or-death drug, one company making it, they double the price, triple the price, five times, you're stuck. And when I talk to hospital administrators in Illinois and health insurance companies in Illinois. They say, you want to know why premiums are going up? 25% of it has to do with the increased cost of drugs. We have no control over it. Mm-hmm. They're just raising them to high heavens. So it really all plays back into something that Congress should play a role in solving.
Well, here's my worry that all the pharmaceutical CEOs saw what happened yesterday. She took the heat. She walks away. Business as usual. And they're thinking, well, why can't we do this then?
Well, some of them don't want to face the criticism, the investigation, and the rest of it. But, you know, others are in it for the $7, $8, $10 million annual salary they're going to get.
Oh, she got $18
million. Yeah, $18 million, not to mention stock value, which I'm told is huge. So, you know, when it comes right down to it, all you can do is shine a light on it and hope that moves Congress and a president to do something about it.
That was Senator Dick Durbin with Scott Laughlin. A new report warns of an impending teacher shortage crisis in the U.S. The Learning Policy Institute reports the U.S. could be short 100,000 teachers by 2025. Professor and Chair of Teacher Education at Bradley University, Dean Cantu, explained why when he talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Why do you think that is?
Well, one of the things in the most recent report that was issued last week by the Learning Policy Institute, and this is a national report, Terry, and it's shedding the same light on the problem that that was focused on in the IASS report issued earlier in this year. They basically have found four variables that have contributed to this shortage. One is a declining number of individuals going into those teacher education programs you just mentioned a moment ago. The second thing is a lot of school districts, if you recall, in the 2008-2009 recession, there was a tightening of the fiscal belt by state legislatures across the nation. You started to see a reduction in individuals in the teaching force. There were some layoffs, that kind of thing. There was an increase in the student-teacher ratio. So now there's an attempt to get back to that pre-recession student-teacher ratio, which means you have to hire new teachers. In fact, if we, across the nation, if we wanted to just go back to that pre-recession student-teacher ratio in K-12 schools across the U.S., we'd actually have to increase by 114,000 teachers today just to get back to that. A couple of other contributing factors are an increasing, although it's a modest increase, the U.S. Department of Education forecasts an increase over the next 5 to 10 years in K-12 student enrollment. And then the other thing, of course, is we have individuals that are leaving the profession, and we have to do something about the teacher attrition rate, which currently is about 8% annually. So all of those combined have contributed to this shortage crisis, if you will.
Things are different now. For instance, when I was a child, the teacher had the support of my parents. And I would argue that today, that's not so much the case. It's almost as if it's parents versus teachers in some situations.
Well, I'm not quite sure if I would characterize it that way. I am a former high school teacher. My wife is a current teacher, and I wouldn't necessarily say that there's an antagonistic relationship at all between teachers and parents. I think there's still a number of bridges there, and there's a reliance on there's this reciprocal relationship, if you will, between the teachers and the parents, and we have a common goal, and that is the education of the P-12 or K-12 students that are in our charge. I think there are other factors that have contributed to the higher teacher attrition rate that the report focuses on nationwide. Some of the things they look at are things like salaries and compensation, induction and support for teachers when they're first entering the profession, for example. Do districts have mentorship programs? You know, are there incentives, you know, for these teachers? Some states are actually to try to attract teachers to their states. They have programs that are forgiving student loans if you went through a teacher preparation program. They're giving, actually some states even have signing bonuses, if you will. So there are different things that can attract people and retain people in the profession. So I think those are greater contributing factors to decisions that some teachers make pre-retirement to leave the profession.
pensions are one thing, especially here in Illinois, where the teachers look, you know, in Illinois, I know, I don't know the rules in all the other states, but I know that they do not pay into the Social Security system while they are educators, and they rely on a pension from the state. But there's been a lot of talk about pension reform and changing that. And could that be scaring some teachers that they may not have the retirement they need after putting in, you know, 30, 40 years at the school?
Well, I think absolutely. That's one of the, you know, when they poll the teachers on reasons why they are, you know, they're leaving the profession, you know, that's one of the things that weighs heavy is their current compensation and concerns about pensions, about retirement. And that's nationwide. But you're right. You know, for example, my wife is taught in three different states, and each of them had a different approach to teacher pensions. So what you have as a result, because it's up to individual states, you have competition among the different states. So, for example, you know, my wife taught in Missouri and Indiana before we came to Illinois. You know, these are all, you know, border states. So they're in effect, we're competing with one another for this this small supply of teachers, because again, you know, the shortage shows that the demand exceeds the supply. So we're all basically trying to attract the same teachers in Illinois that they're trying to attract in Iowa, Missouri, and Indiana and Wisconsin. So we want to try to remain competitive in that regard, without a doubt.
That was Bradley University's Chair of Teacher Education, Dean Cantu, with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Actress and songwriter Linda Thompson was a regular on TV for many years, but now might be best known for her romance with Elvis Presley and marriage to Bruce Jenner. Thompson writes in her memoir, A Little Thing Called Life, how Jenner revealed his transgender identity to her long before coming out publicly. Thompson talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
So let's cut right to, I guess, the first big romantic story in your book. When did you first meet Elvis?
Oh, gosh, July 6th, 1972, to be exact, around midnight. So I guess technically that would be July 7th. But I met him at the Memphian Theater. He used to rent out the movie theater and show usually double features, because back then we only had three, you know, four stations, and TV went off by midnight. And so to entertain himself, he would rent out the Memphian Theater. And I was invited by a mutual friend of ours to come to the theater and to meet Elvis and to see the film.
Do you remember what movies he wanted to see?
Oh, not even close. That's been a joke for a running joke for many years, that neither Elvis nor I remembered what movies he was screening that night, because we were so sort of entrenched in each other's attention. You know, it was very funny because once I discovered that he was not married anymore, and you know, he was hitting on me, and I was very standoffish. And finally he said, honey, you know, I'm not married anymore. So then, you know, we started talking, and, you know, through two features, got to know each other pretty well sitting there in the theater, since he rented it out and he could talk as loudly as he wanted. And neither of us remembered at the time, and nor do I now, what movie he was showing that night. It was two features, so I have no idea. Probably something to do with karate.
That just seems so appropriate.
I know. You
mentioned that it was around midnight, and that was kind of a little bit of the type of hours that Elvis kept. What was it like to get
Absolutely.
Into that world, to be part of Elvis's world? Because he sort of did have to separate himself from what we would consider everyday normal life.
Absolutely. It's a good observation that, you know, his day kind of began when the sun went down. He was very nocturnal. And, you know, really, we lived our lives after the sun went down. You know, we lived like vampires, we used to joke. And after a while, I have to be honest, it got to be a little depressing, because, you know, there is that seasonal disorder, depression, that people suffer from. And living your life and primarily in darkness was depressing. So it was a very interesting lifestyle that we did live. And after a while, it got to be a little oppressive and depressive.
Do you think that affected Elvis as well, the not spending a lot of time in the daylight?
Yeah, I think it probably did without his being cognizant of it or my being aware of it either at the time. But I think it must have, you know, I just think that that's a very real thing that we all need light and sunshine. And, you know, we had moments of it. We would, in Las Vegas, you know, we would wake up and go outside and lie in the sun and, you know, soak up some sun. So we did have, you know, times that we would spend in the sun. But for the most part, you know, our lives were lived in darkness. And I think that that, I think it must have had an impact on his mood.
Elvis definitely was sort of the alpha male amongst his group, his posse, and his world. And so it's interesting to see that you write that Elvis had insecurities and he kind of went through a bit of a midlife crisis. You detail that a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think it's so important to point out, too, that we are all human. And that takes nothing away from the greatness of anyone or their accomplishments or their contributions to the world. It simply connects them, you know, those, you know, idealized few, it connects them to the rest of humanity. So he was no different from anyone else in that he had insecurities and, you know, he would go through the same antics that all of us do and we think we're getting older and, you know, losing your looks or whatever. So he kind of went through that. And he, you know, he was a very shy and humble man at the very core of his being. So I think it's nice to understand, and it's important for people to understand that, you know, we have a tendency to put celebrities on a pedestal and not allow for them to be human. And it's a disservice to the person who is famous, you know, to be isolated like that. They're isolated enough by their fame. So, you know, you need friends to surround you and people who love you to just be very real with you. And, you know, certainly Elvis and I shared that kind of relationship where we were honest with each other to the extent that we could be, given some of the things that we went through.
I think with your former husband coming out as transgender, you probably have a lot of people ask you questions. And I'm sure they did before your book came out. And you're very candid about that life in your book. And you write in the book about Bruce Jenner confessing to you while you were married that he had gender dysphoria. How long in the marriage did he come forth to tell you this?
Well, I write about it in detail in the book that we had been married. We'd been together probably about 6 years. I had already had two sons with him. There was absolutely no indication that there was anything other than, you know, masculine instincts, you know, coursing through Bruce Jenner. And people ask me that, well, were there any signs, were anything going on there? You, looking back, can you, you know, kind of discern now, oh, that makes sense? No, absolutely nothing. This was all man. This Bruce Jenner was just, you know, the most masculine of men. I had never met anyone that masculine, that athletic, you know, and that seemingly comfortable in his own skin. So for him to come to me when Brody was 18 months old and Brandon was 3 and a half, and tell me that he wanted to transition, that he was transgender, that he identified as female, was beyond shocking. You know, it was devastating. And we immediately went into therapy. I did keep his secret for 30 years, you know, until she emerged, until Caitlin came out on the Diane Sawyer special. And, you know, that kind of freed me up to finish writing my memoir, because I had started writing it about 11 years ago, but I had to put it away. I was about, you know, an introduction and 4 chapters in, and then thought to myself, I would never betray that confidence. And, you know, I kept Bruce's secret for all those years, and I had to wait until Caitlin emerged, and then, you know, I was free to write about my life. And there have been so many stories along the way, so much misinformation, and, you know, about me as well as other people in my universe, you know. So I felt it was finally time to tell my own life story from my perspective and not someone else's. I think it's important that, you know, Caitlin tells her story from her perspective. I tell mine, you know, we're all kind of in this together. and, you know, it's important also, I think, to point out to everyone, I know it's a very difficult thing to understand, but I don't think that we necessarily need to understand someone's plight or someone's life in order to accept it. You know, I think it's important for us to just be kind, and if you can't help someone, at least don't hurt them in their journey.
That was actress and songwriter Linda Thompson with Steve Fast.
As we get set for the presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, a Lincoln historian is drawing some contrasts and some possible comparisons between those and the now famous Abraham Lincoln-Stephen Douglas debates. Guy Fraker of Bloomington talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
Do you think years from now, and I'm talking, you know, 150, 200 years from now, people will be talking about the great Trump-Clinton debates like we speak of the great Douglas-Lincoln debates today?
The reason the Douglas and Lincoln debates are so renowned is they were a watershed in American history because it's what elevated Lincoln to become a national figure. And so it depends. I think it depends on the outcome. Usually these things are fairly inconsequential in the long run.
Because they're not debates in the sense that the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Talk about the format of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, because we don't have the attention span for that today.
That's exactly right. Yeah, if anything, the format criticizes the American voter today, because the format there was the opening speaker spoke for an hour, then the opponent spoke for an hour and a half, and then the opener got a half an hour to close. So it was 3 hours of people standing. This was in August and September.
Yeah.
Standing in the heat and listening to these two guys go at it.
And no, and today we have a moderator or moderators.
Correct.
There was no moderator.
None.
So how did they decide what topics they would? Well, in that format, I imagine they covered pretty much everything there was to cover.
They did, although, of course, slavery, the extension of slavery was the real issue. And so that it was focused on that, but there were other issues as well that came up in the course of the debates. The debates arose in an exchange of correspondence between Lincoln and Douglas. So those two guys themselves set the terms, and Lincoln forced the issue by, I think, intentionally going to Monticello, Illinois, where Douglas was appearing, and confronting him on the road as they met from going from Bement to Monticello, and confronted him. And I think he forced Douglas, who was a proud man, he forced him to agree to debate.
Were there debates before?
I'm sure there were.
Presidential debates before?
No, this was, of course, for the Senate.
Yeah.
This was for the Senate. No, here's the interesting thing. This was the first campaign for the United States Senate that was ever directed to the people, because you remember the legislators chose the senators. So the legislative races determined who. And
so the House.
The House
chose
and
the
Senate.
Senators. Okay.
The House and Senate and the legislature. So nobody had pitched a campaign before to the people till this one. And it just sort of evolved the way it did. And it did definitely made Lincoln a national figure.
You know, Trump suggested, I don't know when it was, last week, a couple weeks ago, that they should just get rid of the moderator.
Well, that would lead to, of course, two screaming matches. And if you had a set format where somebody got to go for the set period of time and somebody else had to, the other guy had to stay shut up.
You clip the mic.
You clip the mic.
Somebody suggested that. I can't remember who it was. A piece I saw suggested you put them, two podiums on a stage, but they're so far apart that you would only be able to hear them on the microphone. So there wouldn't be any, you know, you go back to a debate, 12 years ago. The sigh from, I think it was, I can't remember who the candidate was.
I don't either. Yeah.
That got
Al
on the
Gore.
Microphone.
Right.
Al Gore. Thank you very much. I just got it in my ear. Al Gore. You would eliminate that. They suggested you have, let's say, 30 minutes to talk.
Right.
And then after your 30 minutes or 20 minutes, whatever, your mic is off.
That could work.
That might be. Hey, you know what? Why not? Because we see these debates and they don't amount to much.
No, there's sound bites, which is all, you know, we in America today live off sound bites. So it fits that. It's almost like it's pitched to what the people will put up with.
Well, we'll talk more about Trump here in a second, but we were talking Hillary. There's always seems to be, during a debate, a candidate who has nothing to gain. And only everything to lose. Getting caught in a lie or misspeaking or messing up oops, like the Texas governor right. did. That's Hillary Clinton, if you ask me. We know everything there is to know about Hillary Clinton.
That's true. And there's a similarity here between Douglas and Clinton. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that Douglas's politics, which he was the, quote, conservative mm-hmm. on the race issues, and Lincoln was the liberal. So I don't mean in that sense. But in the sense of being a person whose integrity is questioned by many people, who's very well known and has nothing to gain, as you just pointed out. Yeah, I think Hillary and Douglas were very much in the same boat.
All right, so let's do some comparison with Donald Trump and his last time I talked to you, I said Trump taking a page from Lincoln, because you said before Lincoln, this was prior to him running for Senate and
right.
the debates,
right.
was a bit of a bully.
He was. He, in the 30s, his sense of humor was such that he used it effectively, but in a nasty way in some of his campaign appearances. And he actually drove an opponent. It wasn't his opponent, but he was speaking in the congressional race of 1836. This guy was running against his former law partner, John Todd Stewart, who was of the same party. And this Lincoln started to mimic this guy. His name was Thomas. They called it the skinning of Thomas. The man had a limp and he had a lisp. And Lincoln, in his response, did both those things. He limped onto the stage like Thomas walked, and then he spoke in the same peculiar manner. And the man literally ran from the stage in tears. Lincoln just destroyed him. And they say that experience transformed him. Transformed Lincoln. And after that, the nastiness that we associate with Trump was gone. And so by the time he was even out of politics when the slavery issue rose in 54. But for that run in the 50s, this was the kinder, gentler Lincoln.
Boy, we hear sound bites now with these ads against Trump. Hillary Clinton's camp talking about how Trump, and she'll even say it when she's speaking publicly, how he mocks the handicap. Mocks women, blah, blah, blah. And here, Lincoln mocking, obviously, a guy who had some kind of ailment because right. he was limping.
Right.
To the point of tears?
That's what people said. Of course, as you know, we had no electronics
right.
then, so this is all based on firsthand accounts, but it's a pretty consistent version of the event.
That was Lincoln historian Guy Fraker with Scott Laughlin. The Weekend News is next. This, WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Unit 5 leaders continue to scramble to transport students while new drivers are trained and could even ask the governor for help. Superintendent Mark Daniels says it might be time to ask for help from emergency services and even the military.
We're thinking about going to the governor now and saying, is this not executive order time? And utilizing police, utilizing firemen, even utilizing our reserves, our National Guard. I mean, we have to get kids to school.
Daniels says even if Guard soldiers don't have commercial driver's licenses, their logistics could help. It's looking more and more like an east side highway for McLean County might never happen. Jerry Payonk, project manager for the highway that's been in the works for decades, says the rate of population growth has slowed to the point where, for now, a new highway connecting Interstates 74 and 55 east of the Twin Cities isn't necessary.
So we might say, okay, we're going to look at all the different areas on the east side, and if half of them reach that 2.2% population, we might want to approach the board and say, okay, we're reaching a point where we need to construct an east side highway.
The highway project is hosting a public meeting at Central Catholic High School on October 19th. The Bloomington City Council is reviewing a request to spend $43 million on street resurfacing over the next 5 years.
Alderman Scott Black says he has concerns with a lack of priority given to the city's aging and historic districts in the plan.
Is that really the best use of taxpayer dollars to be resurfacing, widening roads that are not needed when you have critical infrastructure in our historic neighborhoods that have not been addressed and are not part of this plan?
Black says he's not against street and sidewalk improvements in the city. He just wants to see taxpayer dollars spent efficiently. Bloomington officials met this week with various downtown stakeholders to discuss the future of downtown. Community Development Director Tom Daybriner says they need input from these businesses and building owners to figure out the next steps in their comprehensive plan.
There are small items, everything from wayfinding signs to major parking decisions, types of uses to emphasize. You know, do we want apartments? Do we want more retail?
Downtown business owner Jamie Matthews says he's seen a lot of progress in the area, but still sees a need for things like additional parking. The Normal Town Council is allowing the former Illinois Soldiers and Sailors Children's School Administration Building to be demolished. The town has approved a deal that includes reimbursing owner Nicholas Africano for the price of the demolition, which is expected to be $500,000. Councilman Jeff Fritzen says the building has become a liability.
There has been, you know, some vandalism, and it's a bit of a magnet for some young folks to have an adventure, and some have gotten into trouble having those adventures.
The agreement also has Africano handing the land over to the town after demolition, though he has the option to buy the property back within 2 years. Up next, the week to come. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Mid-Central Community Action in Bloomington will launch a new domestic violence awareness campaign. Tuesday is National Voter Registration Day, and a number of local groups will be working to get people registered. Also Tuesday, Bloomington Normal will be officially designated an official gateway community to the Abraham Lincoln National Heritage Area. On Wednesday, former McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen is expected to change his plea in his wire fraud case. Also Wednesday, the Normal Public Library Board will consider hiring an architectural firm to design a new library building. On Thursday, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council will be hosting BN by the Numbers at Illinois State's Bone Student Center. Chairman of the National Home Builders Association will deliver the keynote presentation. And on Sunday, a silent protest against abortion will be staged near David Anderson Park along East College Avenue in Normal. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.